Thank you, Marcel. I did miss 1 year because I had to be at a reading of my own, but I've been here every year, basically doing the same job, which is to invoke the presence of Larry's spirit. And one way I've done that this evening is to wear a t-shirt that belonged to Larry. It came to me after Larry's death, and so I'm wearing this shirt in his honor. And in fact, I wanted to tell you a little story about this shirt and what I do when I wear this shirt. Every time that I put this shirt on, I declare it a Larry Day. And during a Larry Day, what I'm actually doing is I'm living for two people at one time. It's as though I'm looking at the world through two sets of eyes, or allowing his presence to inhabit me. And that's kind of a dangerous thing to do, actually, as you might realize. But basically, I just go through the day and do the normal things that I would do. And, you know, maybe you think that's a little macabre or odd or something, but I don't feel that way at all. What I do is I think of it as, you know, inviting him to leave the kingdom of the dead and come back here to whatever kingdom this is, and to do all the things that I was going to do that day. So it's like, you know, just living with another presence inside me. So I thought I'd tell you just a few things about things that Larry and I did today. We were supposed to go play basketball, but we never got around to it because we lost track of time, something both of us have a habit of doing. Most especially if time is limited and short, then that's when we don't do that. Another thing that Larry liked to do, we showed up a little late for a graduate student conference that we had that we were supposed to do. But we really did enjoy talking to the intelligent and talented graduate student we talked to. And we talked about Ezra Pound, and we talked about Yeats, and we talked about Wallace Stevens and the idea of order at Key West. And we talked about Robert Lowell's For the Union Dead. But Larry thought that was going a little bit too heavy on the irony, so he wanted me to stop. He thought that was a little too weird. Then we went off to the post office to do a favor for some friends, and when the clerk was rude, we didn't get upset, and instead we tried to imagine what sort of day he might have had, and maybe what sort of night he had last night. And then we went over to look at the posters of the criminals. We looked at the interesting stories, and we pondered their identifying marks, and then for a light bit of revenge, we imagined what might happen if one of the criminals actually walked through the door right then and went up to the rude clerk. But then we kept imagining, and we imagined an unexpectedly hilarious ending for that event, and then we got out of the place quickly just in case. We enjoyed the warm, muggy weather, not entirely unlike the weather of heaven or hell, and we enjoyed the fact that for whatever reason, even if it was the terrible Britney Spears, who does seem to have a wonderfully poetic name, if nothing else, all the young women seemed to be wearing cut-off shirts and low-slung pants that exposed their midriffs, and we observed those little blobs of fat that ride along and jiggle up and down on their lower backs, and we pondered how it was that perhaps that was our own least liked physical trait, but nevertheless on them it didn't seem nearly so awful. And then it was time to write this introduction, and I asked Larry to help me with that too, and of course he did. He's a generous guy. The first thing that occurred to me when I was trying to write this introduction was that it seemed to me that I should ponder again the very strange mystery of how we were pretty much inevitably fated to meet sometime or another, because we lived in so many of the same places, you know, Missouri, and we have close friends in Fresno, I have close friends in Fresno, and Utah, and all these places that I lived at the same time. But he was always following along behind me. You know, I just want to make that clear. But it seemed like it took an awfully long time for us to finally get together. But when we did, it was really worthwhile because we understood each other's stories so well. You know, we could just refer to people and places and things. And we understood exactly what we were talking about, including really obscure figures like my first writing teacher, Thomas McAfee, the very first person I ever studied with. He was a colleague of Larry Levis's and knew him. And in fact, one of the things that Tom did was... And I'm remembering Tom as well, who is also another poet who's moved on to wherever poets go to. Well, you know where they go to. He wrote a poem in his almost last book called The Body and the Body's Guest, an allusion to a poem by Sir Walter Raleigh. And this poem is called Larry Levis Has a Poem About Writing a Poem. Now, in order to understand Tom McAfee's poems, you have to understand that they are incredibly compressed, and they're compressed by this tremendous, powerful weight of enormous irony. Not a dump truck's worth of irony, not a freight train's worth of irony, not something like a continent's worth of irony goes into these writings, poem. But this is addressed from Tom McAfee to Larry. You had all the advantages. First of all, you wanted to write a poem. You had somewhere to get to and something to slick your hair back about. I sat in that damned airport and wasn't going anywhere. I was leaving, and I had a long time to wait. Now, that deeply ironic poem is a reference, of course, to, and I thought that this evening I would vary from my practice in the past when I've always referred to poems from late in Larry's life, that I would refer to some poems from early in his life. And of course, the poem that he's referring to there is the one that you all know so well, The Poem You Asked For. This is by Larry Levis, The Poem You Asked For. My poem would eat nothing. I tried giving it water, but it said no, worrying me. Day after day, I held it up to the light, turning it over, but it only pressed its lips more tightly together. It grew sullen, like a toad, through with being teased. I offered it all my money, my clothes, my car with a full tank, but the poem stared at the floor. Finally, I cupped it in my hands and carried it gently out into the soft air, into the evening traffic, wondering how to end things between us. For now it had begun breathing, putting on more and more hard rings of flesh, and the poem demanded the food. It drank up all the water, beat me and took my money, tore the faded clothes off my back, said, "Shit," and walked slowly away, slicking its hair down. Said, "It was going over to your place." I started pondering how there is also an irony. Actually, Larry led me into this, of course. It's all his fault. This introduction is his fault. I don't have to take any responsibility for it. See, I gave it to him, the job to help me with it. I began pondering the irony of how people think all the time, and they mention it to me all the time, about how Larry was obsessed with death at the end of his life, and he seemed to be predicting his own death, and he seemed to be all, you know, everything about his life was clouded over with death. And of course, those of you who know him know that was perfect nonsense. It was just absolute nonsense. He was very much alive and was really enjoying his life. He had a hell of a good time. And one of the things that occurred to me to answer to them is that, well, if you look at his life, he was writing death-obsessed poems his whole life. I mean, he was very young. He was writing death-obsessed poems, elegies and other kinds of poems. I thought that I might read to you one from The Dollmaker's Ghost. This book was published, when was it published? 81, something like that. So certainly a whole, 1981, a whole lot longer ago than maybe some people might have thought. The wish to be picked clean. I still oversleep these winter mornings. I still can't decide. Last night, I desired only a stillness in the wake of each thing. The air held inside a dead spider on the sill or inside a shell washed up this morning. Or even the air of a struck chord when the pianist seems to lean over slightly as if he strains to hear a note just under his own held breath. I wanted once to be picked clean by music, by wind, by sunlight. I would stand outside in the winter dusk. I would think of those extinct Scottish poets who placed stones on their bare chests and then laid down in snow each night until the right poem came. They praised always the hard ways of their lord. Their grins frightened even their wives. It took me 15 years to learn how not to pray. And tonight I toast a blind black man with a cane who I met once in Louisville, whose socks were unmatching. One a fading gold, one white. It was humid in the park, and he sat there, smiling at each thing I said. I thought he liked the feeling of the sun on his face, or on his hands, or that he liked my company. I learned later that he was simply terrified, and that a gang of boys had crept up earlier with sticks. I was too young then. I was nothing then. And in the morning, he was not there. I still wake up with no beliefs, but looking out this year at the brown grass, I think that frail man is dead by now, and though I do not know if the veins on the backs of his hands were sacred, they stood out while he listened, as if his blood was thinking. If I could imagine him now, picked clean and without pain by the salts of his own body, as the top of his cane must have been polished for years by the sweat from both his thumbs, it would be easy. It would be a wind no thicker than your wrist over this page, or the music of wind when you hear it suddenly sitting alone in a cafeteria in Louisville, while the river there, the glittering Ohio, goes on with what it does, and each night over it the stars are bright and deep, and no one speaks to you. Now, the last thing I thought I might do to invoke Larry's spirit is maybe to dispel some of the self-consciousness I started feeling, that you all might think I was a real weirdo wearing one of Larry's shirts and doing this whole weird thing with him looking out through my eyes and everything. So I just thought I'd let him answer to your feeling that I should be feeling self-conscious about that. And this is from an essay called Bell's Tavern. And I'll read the first part of it and the last part of it, and that'll be the last thing I'll do. And then I'll introduce Steve. This is called Bell's Tavern. You might know where this place is. You'll recognize from the description where this place is in the city of Richmond. Larry, for a long time, didn't have a car, and he used to walk from VCU to his home in Churchill. Each day, walking to work or walking home, I passed the place where Bell's Tavern once was, not far from the river docks and a block past the farmer's market. There's nothing there now but an asphalt lot under a freeway overpass, and no one there except a pair of men who look homeless, who sometimes sway a little as if they've been drinking when they walk ahead of me, lurch to a stop together, and confer about something. Bell's Tavern is no more now than a few square yards of dark, acrid air and windblown trash, but it was once a recruitment center for the Confederacy. It was also the place in which the plot to assassinate Mr. Lincoln was invented, or where it gave birth to itself, since the idea was no one's. It flew into the smoky tavern on the wing of a joke. All jokes have only one wing, and this is why they can only fly in large circles, and why, incidentally, we find them funny. The joke that would become Mr. Lincoln's death took the shape of a casual remark in order to be born, and nourished itself on smoke and laughter. But the assassination was carried to its fruition because of an oversight and misunderstanding on the part of Booth. What they call a defect now, that tragedy in falling from some great height, is no longer possible. Booth was an actor and still did not realize that because of this gift which had made him famous, there was no Booth, only a series of manifestations in which he inhabited others, exhausted them on stage, and then withdrew, not into himself, not into Booth. Booth wasn't there. Of course, Booth still thought he was Booth, even as the plot began to assume a serious shape in his mind, even as he began to consume more brandy in the evenings. His friends at Bell's sometimes thought it was odd that Booth did not act the way a famous actor should have acted, that he seemed so like the others who drank there, so ordinary. For one thing, he complained all the time, which is what everyone else did at Bell's who didn't have a career on the stage. Like men up from the docks, Booth complained about the usual things, even weather and horses, though he worked indoors and did not own a horse. In a week or so, he became more specific in his complaints: a bout of insomnia, a flu that kept him in bed for 3 days, a stage manager he had always felt contempt for. One afternoon, a wren with gray wings and faint yellow throat and underbelly flew into the tavern, alighted for a moment on a rafter behind the bar, then flew out again. Booth glanced at it, and afterward seemed sullen and bitter. His friends left him to his mood and went on talking. How could they know? Booth was suspicious of the wren's colors, thought that gray and yellow did not belong together, thought further that the wren was not a wren, but something else entirely. But it wasn't. It was a wren. As the war went on, Booth began to seem, even to friends at Bell's who liked him, too mundane, too much himself. That is, he never seemed preoccupied with anything, not even with the plot he discussed privately with two of them there. And all the while, Booth was trying to play a character who didn't exist, someone who had never been there in the first place. In a way, he did a good job of it, for to be alive and not to inhabit yourself is only rare when it continues, uninterrupted by anything. Each day, there are long moments when most people, a majority in fact, aren't there, though they appear to be, sitting under a hairdryer or lecturing behind a podium of blonde wood on the hitherto unacknowledged significance of Renaissance putti, or fishing for carp on the May Island Bridge. Long moments pass when all of the three aforementioned are not there, not present, and though they look as if they are, they know they are not. Booth assumed Booth was there, that Booth inhabited Booth, and that everyone else did the same. He thought this was the most incontrovertibly ordinary fact of all, that one not only possessed, but in fact was, in our threadbare word for it, the self. Booth assumed, without thinking about it much, that he enjoyed the same things other ordinary people enjoyed, drinking brandy at Bell's, complaining and plotting the assassination of the President of the United States. Booth thought all this was completely ordinary without ever realizing that being completely ordinary and being completely insane is the same thing. There's nothing there now where Bell's Tavern was, but litter, oil stains, gray flange after flange of steel and girders, the constant milling, breathy sound of traffic, like a sawmill when the lumber has gone through, but the blades continue for a moment or so afterward. You say one thing is like another thing. You bring the two different things together to see if they align. If they do, it is a way of being there, a way of inhabiting who you are. Booth lived out his whole life without once inhabiting Booth. In Renaissance Italian art, putti are the diminutive, plump infant angels that crowd canvases and appear with no apparent reason above cornices, eaves, archways, at the edges of sculpture. They look unconvincing, stylized, decorative, a kind of graffiti or defacement over everything, and are painted or given such shapes because, in the artist's mind, they represented nothing. They represented nothing because angels have no souls and have no need for them. Angels, or what is not there, are the air itself. An avenging angel is sent, we say, to destroy something. When he destroys, he does so impersonally, perfectly, and completely, and can do so because he isn't there, is most absent when most present, most apparent, and most invisible when he acts. Booth, whom no one inhabited, was an avenging angel, someone sent to do a job. He stopped with two shots from a pistol, the pain Lincoln felt at knowing completely who Mr. Lincoln was, and the pain he felt simultaneously at not knowing at all who Lincoln was, though he had to be him nevertheless. And me? I passed the begrimed marker affixed to the flange on the overpass that designated the place where Bell's Tavern had been. It was the 7th of March. I strolled through the town and watched the moon rise, full, slow. There was the smell of spring in the night air and a V of geese flying over the rock bar and porno theater on Grace Street. When I got home, I listened to a tape of Coltrane that is hard to find now and to the only remaining tape of a lost Okie who used to sing in the oil field bars around Bakersfield before he was murdered in one of them. I made some coffee and began writing this. I am still writing it, and in a few minutes I will begin turning away from it, getting up, getting ready to welcome the pain that flows into me whenever something is over, welcoming that hour when pain takes complete possession of me, that hour in which one tries to avert his face from everything as if Christ had walked in and sat down in one of the rickety chairs in the kitchen and taken off his hat. That still time when you realize that he doesn't exist, that he has never existed, and yet he is sitting across from you now as if he has all the time in the world. And I will welcome the moments that come in the wake of this pain when I go over it all again, reading the scrawl I've made on these pages, checking it to make sure it has two wings, like the wren who flew into Bell's Tavern and then out again, and not just one. So now that Larry's here, he wants to hear a reading. And he, like all of us, is looking forward to hearing from Steve Scafidi, who I'm proud to say is a graduate of Virginia Commonwealth University, and he also had the wisdom to attend Arizona State University, where he earned his MFA degree. I'm also glad of the fact that he is a person who not only knows how to work with his head, but also with his hands. He's a professional cabinet maker, that is, a real carpenter, and lives in Summit Point with his wife, Kathleen. All the 10 books which were passed along as the finalists for the Levis Prize this year were intelligent, well-made, inventive. All of them were worthy of prizes, and in fact, nearly all of them had previously won prizes. But only one of them seemed to have an extraordinary amount of a quality which I am going to call heart. And I'm going to let Steve's reading illustrate for you exactly what I mean by that. Steve Scafidi.